Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. How prepared are Boston's most vulnerable neighborhoods for a storm like Harvey?
If Harvey hit Boston Harbor, we're wiped out as a city.
Also, after a cancer diagnosis, the first feeling is shock.
The cancer diagnosis itself was, you can't overstate how overwhelming it is. Yeah. It is so surreal. It just felt like this could not possibly be happening to me.
But then come the vast numbers of questions and decisions that can be just as overwhelming. So a Boston-based medical team set out to help patients navigate the medical and emotional challenges that come with modern cancer treatment. Also today, Cambridge-based novelist Claire Massoud on her new novel, The Burning Girl. And we'll talk with Bill Littlefield about point guards, the Patriots, and pugilism. All that and no more alliteration, I promise. Next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. The numbers from Tropical Storm Harvey are staggering. 51.8 inches of rain in Houston as of this morning. 3,500 people rescued, more than 30,000 in need of shelter, and more than $160 billion in damage. And yes, the rain is still falling. Now, while many in Massachusetts have stepped up to help, we can't also help but to wonder, what if something like that happened here? Well, Boston Mayor Marty Walsh was asked about that this morning on Boston Herald Radio.
If Harvey hit Boston Harbor, we're wiped out as a city.
Strong words there. So let's get the perspective from Nasser Brahim. He is senior planner for climate change risk and resiliency at the engineering firm Kleinfelder. Now, that firm was hired by the city of Boston to map out a 3-mile defense of the East Boston waterfront. Nasser Brahim joins us in the studio. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks, Meghna.
So you heard what the mayor said. If Harvey were to hit Boston Harbor, we'd be wiped out as a city. What's your reaction to that?
Well, it certainly would be a billion-dollar disaster, just as it's been in Houston. It's just the type of extreme event that's very hard to plan for and very hard to manage.
I mean, it's a 500-year flood, right, that they're seeing in the Houston area. But I wonder, a rain event or a storm event doesn't even have to be as big as Harvey to expose the major vulnerabilities in places like East Boston, though.
That's right. I mean, this event is really extreme in a number of different regards. Wind, so it's a Category 4 hurricane when it hit the coast. We've only experienced a Category 2 here. Events of that nature would cause, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars in damages. And then add on top of that, the flooding. It would just, you know, inundate basements, inundate infrastructure, be a big disaster.
So I mean, just tell me specifically, I mean, how vulnerable is East Boston right now?
Sure. I mean, in today's environment, today's sea levels, a 1% event, so that's a 1 in 100 chance event, could flood large areas of East Boston. And that includes impacting infrastructure such as the MBTA Blue Line and other highways.
So a one in 100 event, you said?
That's right. So that's another way of saying the 100-year flood. It's better because, you know, a 1% chance event could happen today and tomorrow, whereas if you say a 100-year flood, people think it only happens once in 100 years.
Right. Okay. So, you know, there's the possibility that we might face something like that sometime. We don't yet know. But, I mean, the real question about neighborhoods like East Boston is that there's a surge of development there going on right now. So we have old infrastructure, but new infrastructure on top of that. Has there been an adequate eye kept on climate resiliency with neighborhoods that are changing as fast as places like East Boston is?
Well, I can say for large projects, the city does require developers to submit a climate change checklist. On top of that, Massport, who owns, you know, waterfront property, also has a resiliency policy. And so those policies have really helped to ensure that, especially on the waterfront, buildings are being elevated above what would otherwise be required by FEMA. So in East Boston, all of the most recent developments actually have significant resiliency to flooding themselves.
Okay. So climate change checklist, meaning what?
So the developers have to basically show what types of sea level rise they anticipate to happen in the future, what that could mean in terms of damage to their building, and then what types of proactive measures they're taking, such as raising utilities or making sure that occupied floors are not in the flood zone, to make sure that people are safe and can continue to use those buildings afterwards.
But it's up to the developers to identify sort of what kind of flood event that they're going to be preparing their buildings for?
It starts with the checklist, and then the city, of course, negotiates with developers, informs them of the risks, and suggests helpful policies. And those have actually resulted in change on the ground.
Okay. So I'm sorry to be focusing on this checklist so much, but is this the same thing as the Boston Planning and Development Agency's questionnaire that they require developers to who want a permit to identify changes in the climate, environment, et cetera, et cetera? Is that what you're talking
That's
about?
That's correct, yeah.
Okay. Because earlier today, we actually spoke with Paul Kirshen. He's a professor of climate adaptation at UMass Boston, and he has an issue with the questionnaire. I mean, he says that it's not binding, in his eyes, it's not forcing developers to be proactive, and that on top of that, a lot of buildings in East Boston get grandfathered in, so that he doesn't think that it's enough to really make the neighborhood as resilient as possible.
Well, so the city really conducted its climate change vulnerability assessment just last year, and that vulnerability assessment under Climate Ready Boston, had a number of different recommendations, including changes to policy and zoning. So the city is actively evaluating that, and part of what we've been looking at in East Boston is how can zoning and development reviews change to enforce, more resilient development more broadly, mm-hmm. making it less a little bit less voluntary in that regard.
Okay. So this 3-mile defense of the East Boston waterfront, tell me more about that.
Sure. So the city, as part of Climate Ready Boston, identified vulnerable communities, and East Boston and a number of others were identified as among the most vulnerable to sea level rise and coastal flooding. And so the state awarded the city a grant to evaluate defense ideas for East Boston. And as part of that, we sort of developed a longer-term vision, which is sort of covering the full 3-mile coastline of East Boston, as well as some nearer-term, more bite-sized projects that the city can implement to protect East Boston from those risks in the near term.
Hmm. I wonder how much. So we have defending against coastal flooding. We have individual buildings being made more ready for flooding or climate change. Wonder what are some of the other lessons we can learn from what has happened to Houston? There's the idea of natural barriers to absorb storm surges or to be places where water can drain away or creating better drainage in streets and things like that. Is that part of what we need to be doing in places like East Boston as well?
Absolutely, yeah. And as part of the longer-term vision, we've really identified a number of different opportunities to bring back ecosystems that would help to buffer, the big primary flood protection systems on land. So it really helped to make those investments last longer and also have the added value of improving the harbor and giving people access to those types of natural resources.
Now, putting all of this together, mm-hmm. how much would it cost? What's the cost of being ready for a Harvey-type storm?
It's really hard to estimate the cost of being ready for Harvey because it's so extreme. The city is working right now on finalizing the numbers that will be published, relatively near term on the East Boston proposal. But I can tell you that the costs of not doing something are in the hundreds of millions of dollars. If a 100-year storm hits, tomorrow, that's what we're talking about in terms of damages from coastal flooding. And so we know that the costs of protecting East Boston are lower than that. So it's a fraction of the cost.
Yeah. So let me ask you, I mean, I know it's always quite, there's a dance to do between making a regulation too onerous or versus making regulation so lax it doesn't really make that much of a difference. And perhaps the question I'm about to ask is just largely informed by the fact that we are still seeing and experiencing the catastrophe that has befallen the city of Houston. It just makes me wonder, why shouldn't Boston take the extra step and say, actually, rather than it being, a checklist, that you have the requirement, developers, to be prepared for a 200, 400, 500-year event?
Well, I would say in Boston's defense, we haven't experienced these types of events before.
Neither had Houston until we're proactively planning.
So Houston has experienced very significant floods and hasn't taken the action that they need to. The city is being very proactive in that regard, including looking at those policies and zoning. It's part of their plan to address those in step. It's just, like you said, it's not something you can make a decision on overnight. You've got to really think about the consequences for the city's growth and the tax base and all those things that will factor into how we pay for this over the longer term.
Well, Nasser Brahim is senior planner for climate change risk and resiliency at the engineering firm Kleinfelder. They were hired by the city of Boston to map out a defense for the East Boston waterfront. Thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
All right. Well, in a couple of weeks, let's shift our focus now to the fact that in a couple of weeks, the MBTA is going to have a new general manager, and he is Luis Ramirez. And we've been reporting here on Radio Boston at WBUR about some of Ramirez's previous experiences and what he brings to the job, including questions that have been raised about his leadership at a Texas firm and whether or not he actually turned around that firm. There's also the questions about a lawsuit, a shareholder lawsuit that Ramirez faces, and an SEC investigation. So we have been wondering for some time, was Luis Ramirez fully vetted? What did state leaders know about his company's previous record? And did state leaders feel satisfied by the answers that Ramirez gave? Now, if you're just catching up to reporting on this, I suggest you go to radioboston.org and read up on all the stories that we've been doing over the past couple of weeks. But we were getting closer to an answer about the search process here for the MBTA's new GM because we were able to speak with one member of the search advisory panel. And we've still got some questions for Transportation Secretary Stephanie Pollack. We hope she joins us soon. We have multiple requests out to her. But joining me now to discuss what we have uncovered is Radio Boston's Kathleen McNerney. Hi there, Kathleen.
Hi, Megna.
Okay, so first of all, the one thing that we've noticed is that the search for this GM, for Mr. Ramirez, is quite different than the searches that MassDOT underwent for previous MBTA general managers.
Right. I mean, basically everything changed in 2015 after the crippling winter that we had. The biggest legal change was the creation of the Fiscal and Management Control Board and the giving the transportation secretary the ability to hire and fire the general manager. That's a big change from how things have been done in the past.
Right. And in the past, the MassDOT board did part of its search in an executive session privately, but then interviewed finalists in public before the full board. Okay, so it's been challenging, though, Kathleen, as you and I know, to understand exactly who knew what and when, because
right.
This process has been so private for this particular search. Now, the MBTA has made it clear to us that Secretary Pollack is the person who made the decision. And again, we are still hoping to speak with her someday as and when she responds to our requests. But we've also reached out to members of the 5-person search advisory committee that advised Secretary Pollack.
Right. And one of those members agreed to speak with us on the record, Monica Tibbetts-Nutt. She is the executive director of the 128 Business Council. She's been a member of the Fiscal and Management Control Board and the MassDOT Board since 2015. So really involved in these issues over the last 2 years.
Yeah, and very, very knowledgeable. And so she's told us a couple of interesting things, that she really felt part of her role was to help Secretary Pollack and, in fact, the finalists for the GM, the MBTA GM position, to understand what she felt were important needs that the T had. She also told us that she met Luis Ramirez twice during this process, about an hour total. In those meetings, and we asked her what her impressions were of him, and she said the feedback we got from people he worked with in previous positions was very good.
Right, and as far we asked her about what she knew about Ramirez and the Texas company Global Power Equipment Group, that's the one that we've been reporting at length on. She says she didn't know about the lawsuit, the SEC investigation, or the financial restatements. Quote, that wasn't disclosed to me. Now, the MBTA and MassDOT have not answered questions about whether they were aware of the SEC investigation or the financial misstatements, but had said that Ramirez had been properly vetted.
So, I mean, obviously with the financial statements and the lawsuit and the SEC investigation, there's a lot that still remains to be answered. But, you know, one of the things, Kathleen, that we found that was really interesting is that there's just challenges for anyone who's going to become CEO or GM of the MBTA. And this is one thing that Monica Tibbetts not really pointed out to us. She says, you know, she told us that basically the general manager at the T has, in her words, six different bosses, five board members for the Fiscal Management Control Board, and the transportation secretary as well.
It's not really an enviable position from that perspective. I don't think any of us go, you know what, I wish I had more bosses to report to. So, you know, she just said that's why we're going to dig more into this question of what powers the CEO actually has, because there's a lot that has to get cleared through the Fiscal Management Control Board. For example, any requests for funding over $15 million has to get the board's approval. And the bar is lower for professional services. That would be things like legal, engineering, design. The threshold for that, $3 million. So when you're talking about a huge transportation system, a lot of things need to get approval from this five-member board who may have different opinions and agendas.
Right. So structural challenges for anyone who comes into the GM position at the MBTA. But Tibbetts not also told us an interesting thing. She said that the Fiscal Management Control Board has really gone out of its way to adhere to open meeting laws, post its agendas online, be transparent, essentially. And she did express a little bit of frustration that this hiring process, in her words, was the first time where it seems that, quote, we haven't been completely transparent. And she wasn't thrilled with that.
Yeah, I mean, if you go on the FMCB website, they have all of their agenda items posted. They have their minutes. They comply with the open meeting laws as required. So it sounded to me that she was frustrated because this is something that is a big commitment to her to be transparent. At the same time, she said she's cautiously optimistic about the job Ramirez can do, and she's holding off judgment until we have more facts.
Exactly. Well, we are going to keep investigating on these fundamental challenges that any general manager at the MBTA will have, given some of the structural issues surrounding the T, and that'll be coming up next week, maybe?
Absolutely, sure.
Okay, Kathleen. That's Kathleen McNerney, Radio Boston producer. Kathleen, thank you so much.
Thanks, Magna.
And by the way, you can read all of our reporting on the MBTA's new general manager at radioboston.org. And by the end of the hour, we should have a transcript up of our conversation that we had with Monica Tibbetts Nutt as well. So again, that's all at radioboston.org. We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. A cancer diagnosis can be among the most overwhelming pieces of news anybody ever receives. And then in the aftermath of that diagnosis, it's hard to know exactly what to do, what questions to ask, what information to prioritize, how you go about making decisions and choices for your treatment. Well, there's a book out now aimed at addressing and helping people through those questions. It's written by an oncologist and a palliative care specialist in Boston. It's called Living with Cancer, a step-by-step guide to coping medically and emotionally with a serious diagnosis. And we're joined now by Dr. Vicki Jackson. She's chief of the palliative care division at Massachusetts General Hospital and co-author of the book. Dr. Jackson, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you so much, Magna.
Also with us is Dr. Jackson's co-author, Dr. David Ryan. He's chief of hematology and oncology at Mass General and the clinical director of the Cancer Center. Dr. Ryan, welcome to you.
Thank you.
And we also have with us Jenny Bass. She's a cancer patient of Dr. Jackson's and Dr. Ryan's, and she also proudly tells me she's the mother of two wonderful kids. Jenny, it's great to have you.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
Doctors Jackson and Ryan, let me first start off by asking you, what was your overall goal in writing this book? What is it about our understanding of cancer that you felt needed to be changed?
So we had two big ideas that we wanted to work on with this book. The first big idea is this great experiment that Vicki and I have been a part of at Mass General for the last 15 years or so, and that is the combination of palliative care and oncologic care for cancer patients as they go through the process of getting treated for cancer. And then the second big idea was we wanted to make a book that acted as a guide, kind of a what to expect when you're expecting, except for cancer. We were talking one day, and I said to Vicky, do you drive home at night and answer all these phone calls from friends of friends and family members about their friends and family getting cancer? And she said, yeah. And I said, do you tell the same stories over and over again? And she said, yeah. And I said, well, why don't we write a book?
Yeah. In the beginning, having a diagnosis of cancer, and I'm sure Jenny can talk about this, is incredibly surreal. Like, you just cannot believe this is happening. And there are so many things to learn. And what I always say to patients is, I wish you didn't need to become a competent, capable cancer patient, but you will. Mm-hmm. But in the beginning, it's incredibly disorienting. So in the beginning, it's just understanding what kind of cancer and what kind of treatment and how will I feel and how do I live my life? And that we try to help patients, you know, kind of take them by the hand and take them one step at a time through that process.
So let me ask you, in terms of the bringing together of cancer care and palliative care, when we say palliative care in this context, what exactly do we mean? Because I imagine that some people think, when they hear it, they think end-of-life care.
Yeah, it's a great question. So palliative care is often confused with hospice. Palliative care is a subspecialty, medical subspecialty, where we focus on quality of life for patients with serious illness. So I care for patients with heart failure, with lung disease, with cancer. And when I walk into a patient room, I think when I walked in to see Jenny, I said, my job is to help you live as well as you can with this disease. And I'm going to care about how you're feeling physically, how you're coping emotionally, how your family's doing. So a very holistic approach. Dave takes care of the chemotherapy and all of those interventions, and I'm making sure pain and nausea are in good control and that any patient is able to live as fully as they can while they're living with this illness.
And the key thing is these two are happening together.
That's right.
It's a treatment team.
That's right.
Correct.
Jenny, I have a question for you. I have many questions for you. First of all, what was it like when Dr. Jackson did walk into your room and asked you those questions about how can we take care of you in these other ways?
Right. Well, it was quite surprising. I mean, when Dave recommended that I talk to Vicky initially, I was a little bit nervous because I did think that palliative care meant end-of-life care, and I wasn't ready to think of myself as dying. But instantly, as soon as I met Vicky and she started working with me, it became very clear that, as she said, that she was trying to help me really live my life as fully as possible and to go over, you know, how to cope with things like pain and side effects and emotional distress. So it became very clear to me quickly that Vicky was really there to help me deal with all the parts of my life that were being affected by cancer.
I can see it in multiple ways, right? And on the one hand, when someone first comes in and says, let's also think about these things, perhaps it's a great relief, right? Because you have a team that's thinking about the quality of your entire life. But on the other hand, was it somewhat overwhelming? Because not in addition to sort of the medical fact of your cancer, you had to think about all of these other things?
I mean, the cancer diagnosis itself was, you can't overstate how overwhelming it is.
Yeah.
It is, I mean, as Vicky said, it's so surreal. It just felt like this could not possibly be happening to me. And I was going through physically and mentally, I was going through a lot back last year when I got diagnosed. It was a really big relief to have Vicky come in and ask all these detailed questions about how I was doing and for her to let me know that it would not stay that way, that she would make me better.
Do you mind if I ask? So you were diagnosed in 2015?
2016. So yeah, about a year ago, last July.
And may I ask what kind of cancer you were diagnosed
with? Sure, stage 4 pancreatic cancer with metastases to my liver. So pretty bad diagnosis.
That's an understatement.
Yeah.
How are you doing right now?
Right now, I mean, I'm, you know, very, very appreciative of, you know, the great medical care through Dave and Vicky that I've had. Dave has helped me get on, you know, these treatment path that has really helped me a lot from where I was last year. And Vicky has helped me get through the rest of my life, really, and how to cope with this. So compared to how I was last year, I am doing worlds better.
Yeah. Can you talk about some of the choices or decisions that you made when, you know, regarding those questions about how do we take care of these other parts of your life that Vicky initially asked you?
So, I mean, you know, a lot of it dealt with, you know, different medications and, you know, how to sort of properly treat a lot of the side effects and symptoms. And then there was the emotional piece and, you know, it was, you know, I had to really think about how to, you know, sort of frame the having cancer in a way that I could deal with it, that I could live with it because it wasn't going away. And Vicky really helped me do that. She has this great metaphor of the box where you put these thoughts that you don't really want to think about, you know, that maybe are about scary future you know, things like that, and how you, you know, sometimes open the box and talk about these issues that you don't want to talk about that are scary, and then you learn how to compartmentalize and close the box and try to live your life normally. And so I really try to really take that in and use some of those skills.
Dr. Ryan, how much does the integrated nature of, you know, this kind of treatment that we're talking about, how does that affect sort of the oncology side of things?
Oh, it makes it so much better. Yeah. We've been doing a lot of research around this. It culminated with our colleague Jennifer Tummel in her study in 2010 in lung cancer patients that showed that early palliative care actually does change the outcome. It helps people feel better, helps people be less depressed, and even in some instances can help people live longer. So it's hard. Jenny alluded to it. When you first get diagnosed with cancer, it's overwhelming. There's a lot of things that need to happen. There's portacaths and blood draws and scans and chemo. And so when you're coming in to meet your oncologist, you're feeling rushed because you have to get up to chemo and you want to talk about your blood counts and the chemotherapy and the dosing and the side effects from chemo. And then all of a sudden, your infusion unit appointment, you're already 10 minutes late for that. And you want to run up and make sure that your nurse has the orders ready because you have to be home to get to the babysitter so the kids can move on. And all of that means that you're not talking about all the bigger ticket items, like how is the overall pain management? How am I coping emotionally? You know, what are my strategies to move forward with my life? And I think that does get short shrift in many of the oncology visits. And when we're together with palliative care, all of a sudden it brings that whole aspect back.
Jenny and Dr. Jackson, actually, can I ask you guys a question here? Because I'm still very moved, Jenny, by the fact that you wanted me to introduce you as the mom of two wonderful kids.
Yeah.
Because suddenly it occurs to me that part of the universe of your thinking around your diagnosis had to be like your family,
right,
as well.
Yes.
And was that must have been major parts of the conversations you had with
Absolutely.
The team.
I mean, the most tragic part about this really for me is my two young girls. I have a 5-year-old and a 3-year-old. They're also the best distractions that I have in my life, besides my husband and the rest of my family and friends. But it is exceedingly difficult going through this with my two young girls. So that is something that Vicky and I talk about very regularly.
I think the other piece, it's not just what does this do to a family, like thinking bigger picture. It's also like very practical day-to-day things, right? Like how do we have your pain in good control so you can be a mom? How do we make sure that on days when you feel a little crummy, you can think about how you're going to read with the kids or do other things? So this role of being a mother can be actualized as much as possible, depending upon what's happening with the cancer or the treatment on a specific day. It's not only the emotional coping, but it's all of how the physical symptoms from the cancer and from the treatment impact day to day that really make it challenging.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's an effort when I'm, you know, during my bad days on chemo, I want to be with my kids at all times, but it's hard.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not feeling well, and it's hard to be really present. And I try as much as I can. And my good days, I really am able to be, but it's a struggle.
It's hard on days when people are feeling perfectly
healthy.
So I can only imagine the challenge that presents. So, you know, one of the things that this book does so well, and hearing these stories, it's sort of bringing me to a subject that we've actually talked about on the show quite a bit, and that's how much cancer treatment has changed and evolved over time, going from a place where the focus was purely on the medical treatment of the tumor to this bigger picture of like bringing these other factors into it, the palliative care, the family piece, the emotional, the psychological piece, that they all do sort of work together to improve overall treatment. What is the thing that triggered the idea that we should bring these things together in the first place?
So I think it was a sense that we weren't doing everything that we could. You know, there's really only three things that you can do for somebody. You can do the best standard of care that someone can do. You can do the best experimental care that somebody can do. And you can do the best supportive care. And those three things should be offered at every moment. And in fact, the only thing that you can offer at all times is the best supportive care, because people can't do chemotherapy indefinitely. They're often on and off chemotherapy, or they can't do experimental therapy indefinitely. It's very hard, and most therapies you can't. But supportive care you can always do. And I think it was a recognition we need to do better. And we realized that we needed this specialty called palliative care to integrate into the oncology clinic so that we could provide the best supportive care that we could at all times.
The other thing that I think we've become really aware of over the years is that the relationship that a patient has with their oncologist is really powerful and unique. And there are times when Dave and I would be seeing a patient and the patient would say, Dave, I'm doing fine. I'm great. And then I walk in the room and I'm like, how are things? He's like, it's terrible. I've been in bed all week. And I call Dave and I'm like, Dave, what's going on? He's like, they didn't tell me that.
Why is that?
Well, it's a really great question. And I have asked my patients and they say a variety of these couple things. One time said to me, well, you know, he's trying so hard to treat my cancer and I don't want to let him down. And I just want to make sure that he knows that I'm trying as hard as possible. And somehow describing their pain or other symptoms, I think they worried that would make the oncologist feel badly. I think other patients worry that if they actually say how they're feeling or the worries that are on their mind or physically how they're feeling, that the oncologist will pull back and not give such aggressive chemotherapy. I also think that there are just different roles that we play. I have a different role, and there's a different space that is allowed because I am not holding the keys to the chemotherapy. And I think oncology treatment only gets more complicated year by year by year. There are more new treatments to think about that is a full-time job.
Right. So I want to ask you guys a question, all of the three of you, a question about that in just a second. But Jenny, I mean, I don't want to put you on the spot here, but this is a radio interview, so I might end up doing that. But have you ever had times where you found that it was better to have this team like this for exactly this reason, that maybe you could tell one of them something different? Not that you were saying things that were opposed to each other, but...
Right. Well, I mean, you know, as Dave said, there is so much to learn.
Yeah.
There's so much to learn about biology and about the cancer and about the treatment options. And you know, I had a vague notion of what my pancreas even did before I got pancreatic cancer, you know. But I really feel like my time is best spent talking about those types of things with Dave. And then with Vicky, I feel like my time is best spent talking about everything else.
So just let me just ask, what would be your sort of chief piece of advice?
I think it's don't assume that just because you have cancer and are going through treatment that you are destined to feel crummy. Right? Expect that your nausea will be treated. Expect that your pain will be treated. It would be unusual not to have times that you are worried about what's going on and find a safe place to talk about that, because that actually helps you live more fully with the illness instead of trying to stuff it all down.
Wow. Can I ask you one more question?
Absolutely.
How's your family doing right now?
My family is doing as well as they could possibly be doing. Yeah. My husband and I try to, you know, give our kids, you know, happy childhoods. You know, we try to keep the pain from, you know, my pain or our pain from them as much as possible, and have them live their normal lives. We, you know, the one thing that this cancer has done for us positively is really make us appreciate every single day that we have together. And so we really value every minute that we spend together. And we spend a lot of time doing, you know, family outings and family trips and stuff to spend time together.
Yeah. Well, the book is Living with Cancer, a step-by-step guide for coping medically and emotionally with a serious diagnosis. It's co-authored by Dr. Vicky Jackson. She's chief of the palliative care division at Mass General, and by Dr. David Ryan. He's chief of hematology and oncology at MGH and also the clinical director of the Cancer Center. Dr. Jackson and Dr. Ryan, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And Jenny Bass, a patient of Dr. Jackson and Ryan, and I'm going to say it again, a mom of two beautiful children. Jenny, thank you so much for coming in and sharing your story.
Absolutely. Happy to do it.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and yes, it is Wednesday, which means it's time for sports with Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's Only a Game. Hello, Bill.
Hey, Meghna.
All right, so let's start with the Celtics. And what is this with the Isaiah Thomas, Kyrie Irving trade perhaps not happening because of Thomas's physical?
It's going to happen because Kyrie Irving doesn't want to be a Cleveland Cavalier, and so the Cleveland Cavaliers don't want to have him back. And Thomas would have a hard time returning to the Celtics after the Celtics have made it so obvious that they're willing to trade him for Kyrie Irving. There's some question about some of the details, but I think despite the fact that Cleveland has temporarily balked because of Thomas's hip, that this
right.
will happen.
Okay, so is there any need for the Celtics to sweeten the deal even more for the Cavs? Or
I hope they won't. They're already giving up a high draft pick and several very good players whom Cleveland is certain to find useful. So I hope they won't. I hope that this won't involve giving up anything else.
Okay, and we have tomorrow night as the deadline, or tomorrow morning,
I should say,
the deadline. But you're confident it's going to go through.
Well, as confident as I can be.
As your crystal ball.
Somebody reading the newspaper and taking notes, yes.
Okay. All right. Well, I will revel in your confidence, and let's move on to the Pats then. Because since we're on the topic of injuries, on Saturday the Pats announced that Julian Edelman is going to miss the entire season because of a torn ACL. I feel his pain. I'm one of the ACL clan as well.
Yeah, me too.
The thing is he got this during a preseason game. It makes you wonder why we even have preseason games.
Well, I think we should look at the upside of this. Julian Edelman will not be hitting the head this season.
Oh.
That's good, right?
That is good.
Yeah,
and you can recover from an ACL injury.
Absolutely.
But let me ask you, though. I mean, I think I have heard people grousing about if you're going to lose a star player for an entire season because he played in a preseason game that doesn't even count for anything, what is the point of the preseason games?
Well, I suppose the point is to give coaches an opportunity to see what players can do if they're not already absolutely certain how those players fit into their scheme. And Bill Belichick says that that's what he uses preseason games for, and I'm sure he's not at all unusual in that respect. I do feel bad for a player. It does seem somehow worse to get injured in a game that doesn't count. I'm sure the injury is the injury, but it does somehow, you're right, feel worse.
Okay, all right. So let's move on from that then. Julian Edelman, by the way, we wish you a speedy recovery. And I'm sure with the caliber of medical care he's going to get, it'll be no problem at all. So this is the thing I really wanted to talk to you about, Bill.
I had a feeling there was a certain...
Boxing, your favorite, not favorite sport? Okay, I just want to say the whole nation stopped in its tracks for the Mayweather-McGregor fight. And I'm going to get a lot of hate from haters out there, I know. But I'm just going to put my arm up and my hand up and say, I don't think this fight should have happened. I was rather disgusted by it, and I don't think America needed it.
Well, I'm with you on that.
Vociferous disagreement.
I got a phone call on Saturday during dinner, as a matter of fact, from a friend of mine who said, should I pay $99.99 to watch this on pay-per-view? And I said, I wouldn't watch it if you paid me $99.99. Because I had been convinced several weeks ago by a friend of mine who knows a great deal about boxing that this would not be a legitimate contest.
Well, because one of them isn't even a boxer.
One of them had never boxed before, and the other one has made a career of staying away from anybody who could possibly hurt him, either by refusing to fight that person or by refusing to fight that person until the person had grown old and slow.
Mm-hmm.
And there was no reason to think that Mayweather was going to change his strategy in terms of not being willing to come into the ring against somebody who could actually do him damage.
Yeah, I mean, and look, Mayweather comes out pretty well, $100 million from this fight, this quote, air quotes,
yes. Although
fight,
I understand,
and McGregor
that,
$30 million?
Yes, I understand that the IRS was on his heels for some of fair chunk of that change.
You know, my biggest problem with this fight, and maybe I shouldn't be bringing politics into the boxing ring, but I just don't feel like America needed to see the spectacle of a black man and a white man punching the lights out of each other right now.
Well, yeah, you're right.
For entertainment.
Absolutely. Although that is completely consistent with the history of boxing and has been for a very long time. You can go all the way back to Jack Johnson.
Right.
And certainly to Joe Louis and Max Schmeling, although in that case, there were other political considerations involved as well. So in that respect, I suppose it's no better and no worse than the history of a slimy sport over many hideous years and decades. But the upside, I suppose, is they both got their money. And you know,
and people got 10 rounds of entertainment.
Well, I don't know. It brings up a really interesting point to me, because people are saying this is fraudulent. And to some extent, of course, it is fraudulent, because as you accurately pointed out, one of the guys had never boxed before and he's in there with boxing gloves and a boxing ring. But are you defrauded if you don't think you were defrauded?
Oh.
If you walk away from a spectacle, which a lot of people say, well, that was a joke, that was a fraudulent enterprise, but you were entertained and you don't feel defrauded, then were you defrauded? It's kind
of... You're asking about boxing and not politics right now?
Well, you've picked up the beat marvelously. Oh, well, I can see why we have this job.
I think we need to bring this conversation to a close before we both get in trouble.
It's an existential question upon which to end the discussion. It's kind of interesting, don't you think?
Bill Littlefield brings existentialism and sports together every week at NPR's Only a Game, which airs right here on BUR Saturdays at 7 a.m. and 7 p.m. Bill, thank you.
It was a great pleasure. Thank you, Meghna.
Cambridge-based Claire Massoud is author of the best-selling books such as The Emperor's Children and The Woman Upstairs, books that give life to complex female characters who are independent, imaginative, and even ferocious at times. In her latest novel, The Burning Girl, Massoud turns her attention to the complex tumult that marks the lives of teenage girls. One of them is the perceptive and sensitive Julia. The other, her best friend and secret sister, the bold, unruly Cassie. Their idyllic childhood friendship collapses, but in Massoud's telling, it is this loss of friendship that is their rite of passage into adulthood. And Claire Massoud joins us now in the studio. Welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you, Meghna. It's wonderful to be here.
It's such a pleasure to have you back here.
Thank you.
What is it about... grappling with the lives and friendships of teenagers that drew you to tell this story now?
Well, there are, of course, several possible answers to that, because all sorts of things come together. And one of them is having children and having a daughter who's now 16 and a son who's now 13. So having in the past several years witnessed those adolescent years all over again, and a process which enabled me, for good or ill, to relive my own adolescent experiences. So that's the answer to why now.
Okay.
But I think it also got me thinking about a lot of stuff, and part of the impulse was this sense that it is that those years in which there's so much change so quickly is the time in which our adult selves are forged.
Mm-hmm.
And we intend now, you know, there are many wonderful YA novels, but there weren't when I was young. We tend now to sort of separate that time off from adulthood as though it was a separate sort of sealed period in our lives that as grownups we don't really need to pay any attention to.
Yeah.
And the fact is, it's when we become who we are. And at 13, we are people. You know, we are people with all the complexities that we have at 40. So that was why I wanted to write this book.
Fascinating. Well, so the book is narrated by Julia, and she tells the story. She recounts her childhood friendship with Cassie. And I was wondering if you could just give us a feeling for Julia's thinking from a passage at the start of the book.
Sure. Would you like me to
read? Yes, please,
read?
If you could.
Okay. It's a different story depending on where you start. Who's good, who's bad, what it all means. Each of us shapes our stories so they make sense of who we think we are. I can begin when Cassie and I were best friends, or I can begin when we weren't anymore, or I can begin at the dark end and tell it all backward. There's no beginning before, though. Cassie and I met at nursery school, and I can't remember a time when I didn't know her, when I didn't pick her sleek white head out of a crowd and know exactly where she was in a room, and think of her, some ways, as mine.
Hmm. That's Claire Massoud reading from her new novel, The Burning Girl. I'm curious. There are some really fundamental differences between Julia and Cassie, and as is the magic of childhood, those differences don't really matter intensely to them, between the two of them, when they're young, right?
Yep.
And so just tell us about why you decided to make them their lives and their background different enough so that they do end up later in life, as they get to their tween years, start drifting apart.
Well, I think it may not be a universal experience, yeah, but it's a nearly universal experience. Everybody comes unstuck from a close friend at some point. And I think it's a fairly common time for that to happen in those adolescent years. It is almost as if, as children, we sort of frolic in a hermetic world where we don't have context for things. Mm-hmm. We don't ask ourselves questions. Whatever we're given, we accept as normal. You know, if we don't understand, we think one day I'll understand. We don't seek to understand. We just experience. And then in adolescence, suddenly we look up and look around and start seeing things in the context of a wider world. Is my family normal? Is her family normal? They can't both be normal. Somebody's family's not normal, you know, and versions of that happen in the playground, in the community, you know, and between friends. And so there are so many factors. Mm-hmm. Whether somebody develops physically earlier than somebody else, you know, whether somebody is focused on school or not, whether somebody's family is one way or another, all of those things that didn't used to matter suddenly come into play.
You know, just in hearing you say those words, I have strong recollections right now of one key friendship that I had in elementary school and middle school that for whatever reason, she and I just drifted apart after a while. I think possibly everybody has that kind of formative experience. You kind of hinted at it earlier. Did you?
Yes, I feel I had. We moved around a lot when I was a kid, and I feel like I actually had
internationally.
I had it several times over, but there were a few. You know, there were a few moments that still to this day are baffling to me. And one was in I guess it was sixth grade. I think a close friend came to school one day and said, "I'm not talking to you." And I said, "Why not?" And she said, "You know why."
And did you?
I never, eventually I sort of came through the grapevine, "Wendy doesn't like you because you pout." And I never had any more explanation than that. And, you know, to this day, all these years later, I don't really know what I did wrong.
Yeah. Oh, fascinating. You know, there's one key difference between Julia and Cassie, which maybe I'm reading too much into it, but they have different socioeconomic backgrounds. Their family lives are quite different from one another. And I imagine that, especially in this day and age, class differences over time are very hard for young people to ignore.
Certainly, you know, I don't know the statistics on friendships across social classes, but anecdotally and from personal experience and the experience of my kids, I would say that as you enter those years, those things become more marked. I mean, mm-hmm. If you think of teenage girls suddenly worrying in a way they hadn't before about clothing or about going to hear music or having certain things, certain technology, you know, boys and technology things. Gosh, I'm speaking of gender specifics, whatever. but you know, cross genders, whatever. All of those things that somehow don't matter so much when you're seven. You know, then if you're somebody who can't afford to go to the beach, or you're doing a summer job, or you're in a different position, then those things become obvious.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you get told if you have. My daughter had fake Uggs. She got called out by some kid at school.
Really?
Like, those are fake.
Really?
Yeah.
So I don't know. Are you the kind of author who reads reviews?
Sometimes.
Okay. So because I was reading a couple of reviews that all the reviewers that we saw universally praised you for your incredible writing skill. But a couple of them picked up on what they saw as perhaps you're too good of a writer to be writing in the voice of a teenager. That it didn't quite seem authentic. It was too sophisticated for a teen.
You know, I mean, I have various responses to that.
Yeah.
One is, it's not a reality TV show. It's a work of literature. It isn't. I really don't believe I'm giving Julia any thoughts or experiences that she wouldn't have. Mm-hmm. I may make her more articulate than she might. On average, be. But I'm not writing about average teens. Right. I'm writing about one teen in the voice of one teen. And I would defy you to tell me that no such teen exists in this
country.
Oh,
we know they do.
Right? I mean, I feel like it's not, to quote the Chekhov line, it's not my job to tell you that horse thieves are bad people. It's my job to tell you what this horse thief is like.
Right.
It's who this teenager is.
Yeah, and I think that the central message of the book, that the loss of a friendship can be a defining moment in shaping who we become as adults, is definitely not lost in the sophistication of Julia's voice in the novel. Well, the new novel is The Burning Girl. It's by the fabulous Claire Massoud. It's been such a pleasure to have you back. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Meghna. It's wonderful to be with you. Thank you.
Well, that's it for today. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.